The trouble with being a mama is you worry too much. You worry about why Tommy spits up his milk and smells so sour. Why Archie sucks his thumb. Why Annie can't grasp Spanish. Why Patty has so many boyfriends. How on earth to keep 8 wiggling Cub Scouts still enough to make 8 sparkling pairs of earrings for 8 sparkling mamas? How to get children who don't like eggs to eat good solid breakfast? How to stretch the budget to include those nourishing eggs they leave on their plates? How to calm a husband who doesn't like eggs left on plates that a budget has to be stretched to include? What to do about smelly feet? Why doesn't somebody invent sneakers that don't make feet sweat? How to get a brass fiddle and 4-foot boy to school together without carrying them yourself? How to discipline Billy without warping his personality? How to keep your husband from warping Billy's person? How to iron blouses with no cat faces? How to get Tommy to wear his pants around his waist instead of his hips? How to straighten curly hair? How to curl straighten hair? How to make uniforms for Girl Scouts who are going to serve in the children's hospital? You know this is good training, but you never could look a needle straight in the eye. And why don't the uniforms come ready-made? And if you're a Negro mother, you have a few extra worries. Will Sarah be accepted at Mr. Dudley Watt's dancing school? And can the kids swim in the public swimming pool? How adequate is Joey's segregated school, or how integrated is his integrated school? And what to do when somebody calls him a nigger?
You've been listening to a reading from the book When We Were Colored, A Mother's Story by Eva Rutland. Eva Rutland is here in the studio with me, along with her daughter, Ginger Rutland, and her granddaughter, Eva Fields. Welcome to you all. Eva, I love your book, When We Were Colored.
Thank you.
A Mother's Story. And I love the title. It just went right to my heart. And I so identified with you, since I'm the mother of 4 rascally children myself. I loved the stories. Your sense of humor was just shown through the book.
Thank you.
And you're such a good storyteller. And you started young.
Well, it was the first book I ever wrote. I never thought of writing a book. I was majored in accounting. Yes. I was going to go into business because yes. I didn't want to be a teacher. And I did do accounting for years in Birmingham. For a college there. I was a treasurer.
My goodness. But you published your first story when you were 12. Your Christmas story.
Yeah. And my daddy took it down to the Atlanta Daily Word, you know, the black newspaper there, and they published the little story. I don't even remember what it said.
And you don't still have a copy of that story.
But I always made up stories. I talked to my cousins and I would make up stories for them and tell them tales and sit on my steps. Mm-hmm. But I never thought I would be a writer.
Oh, when did you find out that you were a writer?
Oh, when we moved to Ohio. And my children were faced into the schools that were just becoming integrated. I wanted to talk to white mothers and tell them, my children are just as precious as yours. Yes. Be kind to them. And that's why I began to write stories and send them to the magazines. And as soon as I was sent to the first magazine, they were ready to buy the articles. I was surprised.
And so you kept writing and kept sending them.
Well, I sent them, you know, for a little while, and then they won some prizes. They were published in the Writer magazine.
Yes.
And the Writer magazine gave me 2 prizes. One was for a short story, fiction, that I wrote. And the other one was an article about one of Elsie, you know.
Yes.
And then the Abingdon Press called me and sent a man over that he wanted to publish a book. And I didn't have a book, so he told me to get it together. And I began to write articles for the book. And I would write one article, and then he'd call me again, "Will you please send me another article?"
Oh. Well, you know, that's every writer's dream, to have someone call and say, "Won't you please send me another one?"
Yeah, well, I finally wrote that book, and it was published, I think, in when we moved to Sacramento. When was that? In the 1950s.
Yes, yes.
Then I began to write. Well, we went to Germany. And I didn't write for a while. I fiddled around with it a little bit. But then I came back and I wrote. And then I wrote the kind of stories I liked, the romance stories.
Yes, and those were published. I understand that one can still find those stories on the Internet. If you go to Amazon and look for Eva Rutland, there's your stories.
I have the rights back for about 13 of those stories.
Oh.
And I want to have them published again.
Mm-hmm.
And then I don't have all of them back, but I'm trying to get them back, so I'd like to publish them again. They're a little different from the romance stories now,
mm-hmm.
which are mostly sex.
Mm-hmm.
And my stories tell a tale.
Yeah.
I think they're interesting.
Well, I can't wait to get my hands on one and read your romance stories. They sound like they'll be lovely.
I enjoyed them. I wrote Regencies because I love Georgia and Haya.
Yes.
And I love those kind of stories.
Yes.
And I wrote a few in the modern world of today.
Uh-huh. So most of what you wrote was fiction, and then you wrote the memoir.
Well, no, I wrote the memoir first, Trouble with Being a Mama.
I see.
That was the first book I wrote.
Yes.
And I wrote that because some man had seen the articles that had appeared in Red Book, Lady's Home Journal, and that's why I wrote that book. That's my nonfiction. Nonfiction book. And I'm writing another one now, The Trouble with Being a Grandma.
Oh, really? You have one in the works? I can't wait.
I'm kind of slow with it, but I'm working on it.
When you published your magazine articles, were there other black women published in those articles?
Not that I know of.
Uh-huh.
I don't know.
You
were
unique.
I was very surprised. And then I wrote another story that was published in, what was that published in? I forgot.
Woman's Day.
Oh,
yes.
Woman's Day. I remember Woman's Day. That was very popular magazine.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was Abingdon Press who came to me and wanted the novel. And that's when I wrote the novel.
Well, you know, that's every writer's dream, to have them come to you.
Well, it wasn't a novel, it was a memoir.
That was your memoir.
Yeah, that was The Trouble with Being a Mama.
Which is now called When We Were Colored.
Yes.
I wanted to let our listeners know that when they're looking for the book, which has just been republished, the name of it now is When We Were Colored, A Mother's Story.
Yes.
And it's by Eva Rutland. And you can find it in your friendly independent bookstore. And if they don't have it, they'll order it for you. And it's a wonderful story. Yeah. One of the things that particularly impressed me in your writing is the way you can do a change of mood. You're telling this funny story about the four children and how lively and entertaining they were, and then there's a little twist that comes in, and you say, "Of course, they weren't allowed to go to the town swimming pool."
Yes,
and it just brings us up short. I mean, we're romping along with you and the children. Oh, this is lovely. And then all of a sudden, we realize the limitations that were imposed on you.
Oh, yes. There were many, many limitations imposed on black people.
Yes.
But I grew up with it, and I knew it. And I knew that it was just something that they did, but it didn't stop me from having a wonderful time.
Yes,
I had wonderful friends.
It never got the best of you. That is so impressive as you tell your story.
I don't know why it didn't get the best of me.
Well, you're a strong woman.
No, I think it was because of the neighborhood that I lived in.
Oh.
And I knew that people were people, because everybody played in my yard, because we had the biggest yard in the neighborhood. And I knew that white people were no different from black. Jews were not no different from Protestants. There was, I just found out that people were people.
Yeah.
That was a very lucky thing, even though I wanted to live on the West Side or in the Fourth Ward, where the black people lived.
Yes. Uh-huh. Ginger, I wanted to ask you some questions, too. When you were growing up, were you aware that your mother was writing?
Not really. It wasn't something that I was conscious of. No. I didn't. I knew she was a great reader. She read to us a lot.
Yes.
That she introduced me to Jane Austen at a very young age. She read Pride and Prejudice. It was one of her favorite books. And she read it to us. And she read it to all of her daughters. And we would read it over and over again. And we very much enjoyed it. And she introduced us to a romance writer by the name of Georgette Heyer.
Yes.
And so I knew she loved to read, and she read to us, and therefore I love to read.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any memory of seeing your mother's stories in the national publications?
You know something? When her articles were originally published in Red Book, there was a big, long article called Elsie and God that was published in Red Book in 1952.
Oh, my goodness.
I was 4 years old, and so no, I don't really have a strong memory of that publication. However, I've seen it since I've been an adult, and of course I know it was there, and I have read it from the magazine. But in 1964, the book that she wrote, her memoir, which at the time was called The Trouble with Being a Mama, the one that we now republish and called When We Were Colored, A Mother Story. That I do remember. I was in high school when that book came out, and it was extremely popular, and my mother was quite a celebrity for a year or so, and then it went away.
And we went to Germany.
Yeah, we moved to Europe, and we lived there for several years. And then when we came back, she started writing again. But then she started writing Harlequin romance novels.
I see.
And that is when her writing career really took off. And she became, you know, the Harlequin queen, right? She had so many Harlequin romance novels.
I'm looking for the place in the book where she writes about her children individually and where she writes about Ginger. I thought it was in Boy Meets Girl, but how?
Oh, I know. I can show you.
Okay. I'll let Eva find that because when this came out and you were in the book.
Yes.
Did you hear about this from your friends?
I'm a tad old right now, and I don't really remember the time. I remember being very proud of my mother.
Oh, yes.
And I remember that the book at the time was used as a text in a lot of sociology classes at the time. This was right in the middle of the civil rights era, and she was writing about the 1950s and what it was like to be a black woman, middle-class woman, raised in the segregated South. And suddenly she finds herself in the integrating West. And it was a wrenching change for her.
Yeah.
And she was quite worried about her children being raised in a place with a lot of white people. And she was worried that they weren't going to treat her children well. And that story resonated with sociology teachers of the 1950s and 60s. And they used her book as a text to sort of, I think to introduce black folks to the wider community.
And it's the perfect way to present a period of history in making it specific to a family.
Yes.
And when it's written as skillfully as Eva wrote it, and with as much life and verve in it as well, there's no question but that the dark side is here. But one also sees what a joyful family you were.
Yeah.
And the joys in your life. And I love the stories about open school night and about the Girl Scout troops and all of your activities as children.
That's quite true. What I think is my mother's gift is to take people that you think are foreign,
yes,
are different from you,
yes,
and to show that they are not any different.
That's right.
That white families and black families were struggling with the same thing. You've got a mother here who's trying to get the kids to, you know, to school on time and trying to get the boy and the big bass fiddle and not have to carry him herself. And she's, you know, she's a Girl Scout leader and a PTA president and a Boy Cub Scout leader and all of those things that good parents are. And it's about to wear her to a frazzle,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And she's at the end, she really wonders, why did I join all of those things? Did they really do my kids any good? I think those are questions that I, as a mother, asked later,
yes,
in my own life.
And I love those reflective passages,
mm-hmm.
in which Eva, after you present a section of the story, then you reflect on it. Did I really need to be in all those after school activities?
Yes, and I joined the PTA and I was very active in it. And every year we had to give a play in the fall. And when they found out they couldn't find a play, I wrote one. We gave that, and there were two other women who would come and meet with me. And we would, for the next 3 or 4 years, we wrote the play that was, I wrote the play that was given. But the other women would come and talk with me and give me ideas. And we would give the play.
You don't happen to still have a copy of that play in your drawer somewhere,
yeah,
do you?
I do have a
somewhere. Oh, I'd love to see it.
Oh, and
it was called PTA Pills. And it was really quite clever. And they performed it on radio. And
well, there was a woman who was a counselor at the school, and she was working on her PhD or something. And she came to me and asked me, would I help her write it? And she came over to my house, and I wrote several skits for her. And this was her composition. What is it that you do for... to get a master's.
With a thesis.
But I wrote a little short play for her, several of them, uh-huh. About 10, I think. Uh-huh. And that was her thesis, and she talked about them, of course. And it had to do with what happened in school and all.
I see.
And I have that somewhere. I don't know what.
It'd be fun to bring that play back. Present it.
Well, it became very popular, the plays that we wrote. Each school wanted them, and every fall we would go and give one of the skits that was in my little book.
Besides writing her Harlequin romance novels and the memoir, When We Were Colored, A Mother's Story, she also wrote, and her PTA skits, she also wrote a musical, an actual play. It was called Pride, Prejudice, and Pollution. And it took place on a college campus, and it was about all the different factions on the college campus. There was the woman's group, the black group, the Hispanic group, and it was a fun story about all of these groups competing with each other on a college campus. It was really quite funny. So she's written for the theater, she's written nonfiction, and she's written fiction. She's really a prolific writer. She writes all the time. And her writing took off, seriously took off, after she went blind.
The University of Oregon, I'm not sure, uh-huh. collects her writings.
Oh, really?
Yes. They collect her original manuscripts, and they date back to the 1940s.
So the archives are at Eugene, at the University of Oregon.
Yes, and they're amazing because you can read her talks with her editors. And she wrote a book right after When We Were Colored. She wrote another one called In Defense of Uncle Tom. And this was published in the late 60s, early 70s.
Oh, it was not published.
It was not published, but she wrote it.
The editor that was working with me with that book didn't particularly like it, so they didn't publish it. And I remember I wrote about two black men and what they were doing. And one of them told me, yeah, I know this is the truth. This is very true. But I don't want it written. Because I was talking about his mother, who was a black woman in Alabama. And she had brought him up. Mostly they were farmers. But she knew this boy was brilliant. And he became a very brilliant lawyer in Sacramento. And I wrote about what had happened to him. And he knew his mother wouldn't want to know about it. And another man, who was also an author himself, didn't want me to write his story because it was true. So that book was never published.
This was a sensitive time in American history. Oh, yes. We're talking about the Black Power movement, and you're talking about people who in the earlier civil rights era were now being condemned as Uncle Tom.
Yes.
So Mom is writing a book which she calls In Defense of Uncle Tom. And she really makes a case for a nonviolent, obsequious, careful Black man who is doing what he can to survive, which to younger Blacks may look like he's, in the parlance of the day, Tomming. He was being an Uncle Tom. But what he was really being was survival. You know, he was in the survival.
Smart man who knew how to
survive and thrive in a period in which if you acted out in a violent way, you were going to be killed. And so she was telling that story at a very sensitive time in the history of Black folks in this country where one doesn't want to be labeled as an Uncle Tom. And it's sensitive. And we're hoping that she incorporates her In Defense of Uncle Tom in the book she's writing now, which is a grandmother story.
Yes, it could be told now.
But at least I just wanted to say, of the course, one Eva. Thing is, it take whereas this one finishes with the kids in high school.
Yes.
This one, the next one had the kids in college.
Oh.
And it had a very funny, at least to me, because it's mothers, so it had a very funny section of my mother, Ginger.
Yes.
At Howard with her big afro, and she's now taking Black pride. You know, she's Black power.
That's how it was.
And there's this great part where she's decided to take over the student union.
Of course.
And there's Grandpa on there. What does this have to do with your grade? Yeah.
Typical.
And it's very funny. And but then the other thing is that we have the her talking to the editors who are like, you know, we like this, but we don't think it's very true to life. And we're sorry, it's too controversial. We won't publish it. So we have these original editing, which I found really fascinating.
Extremely valuable.
Mom has not read this book through since the 19, you know, since it was published in 1964, because she's blind and she can't read it, right? So she depends on, I have read chapters to her. My daughter has read chapters to her, but she actually hasn't read the book herself in years. So I'm more familiar with it now than she is, who wrote it.
Can you get someone to record it and have it on Books on Tape?
I have recorded it.
Oh, good.
And we are planning to put it in Books on Tape.
Looks like we'll probably do the CD in the next month or two.
It would be tremendous. Yeah. I think it'd be extremely worthwhile to have it out on a CD.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, Ginger. We were talking earlier about your grandparents. Do you remember them?
I do remember them. Yes.
Yes. You know, I wasn't sure how old they were when they died.
I must have been probably 9 years old when my grandmother died. Maybe 11 or 12 when my grandfather died. My mother's parents, and we lived in Sacramento. I grew up in Sacramento. They lived in Atlanta. So my memories of them are visiting in Atlanta, you know, two summers or three summers. And there they came occasionally and visited us in Sacramento. But I didn't have the kind of relationship my daughter has with her grandmother because she lives in the same town. And I regret it to this day because there's so many questions I did not ask them.
Yes.
I would love to have asked them, for example, did they vote? I don't know whether they had the right to vote in Atlanta. I would have liked to have asked them about the 1906 race riot in Atlanta. I know nothing about their lives, and I know their lives were circumscribed to a certain extent because they were Black. But I wanted to know so much about my grandfather, or my great-grandfather, her father, who was the slave.
Yes.
Tell me about him. Who was his father? When did he get freed? What did he tell you about slavery? I find it amazing that my mother lived at a time when she actually lived among ex-slaves, including her own grandfather.
Yeah.
My grandfather, I don't know, but there was a woman who wrote another book there about the black people in Atlanta. And she wrote about those whose family had been mixed up with white people. She had our family in it. And my grandfather was supposed to be the son of his white master. Mm. And I don't even know if that was true, but that was in this book. Mm. And this book is still in print somewhere.
I was doing my thesis, though, on the Atlanta race riot, and I found the book. It's called A Brief History of Black-White Families in Atlanta or something like that, and it was published in the 1930s or 40s. And what was interesting when I was looking through is that it has the slave picture of my grandmother's parents and their children. So Isaac Westmoreland, his wife Emma, and their 11 children. And it's a eugenics book, though. It's very much, look how well these people did. It has Isaac Westmoreland and going 1/4 Indian, 1/4 black, 1/4 in, which meant Negro, and 1/2 white, because he was the son of his master. Mm-hmm. And then they have the same percentage for his wife. And they have, you know, and they have these little percentages through
the formulas,
it. And then
right.
There's an entire page of hair, like how curly the hair is. And you can tell, you know, from the smart Negroes to the dumb Negroes. Oh. And you can see how the hair gets straighter as they get smarter. It's absolutely disgusting, actually,
yes.
like
yes.
in terms of. But it's all. I also found it interesting because she had a very good history of the family. So I figured out a lot of family relations that my grandmother had mentioned, but I never understood until. But that's the book she's talking about.
So you had to overlook a lot in that book to get to the part that.
I found it a fascinating book.
Yes, but it must have just been horrifying to think how people actually thought that.
Uh-huh, and they had like a whole thing on noses, lips. They had measured the lips. It's a eugenics book, but her family's focused in it and as, look how great they are, because they're mixed with white people, so that's why they're smart.
Okay. Well, we have a really unusual opportunity here with three generations of women in the publishing things about yourselves and your family and your history. And I'm interested in how it works, how you work together on this. For example, republishing Eva's book, When We Were Colored, the recent republication.
That was my idea. Oh. This is Ginger. It was my idea to republish the book. When my father died, we read a portion of this book at his funeral, the portion called The Trouble with Papa. The church was packed. Mm-hmm. Everybody there wanted the book, but the book had been out of print for many, many years. So as a family, we decided to republish it. And I decided to do it. And I changed the title to When We Were Colored, A Mother Story, just because I thought it was evocative of the era and I liked the title. Then we had to figure out how to do it. We had to form a publishing company, which we did. We called it IWP, which stands for Isaac Westmoreland Publishing. Isaac Westmoreland was my mother's grandfather. He was the person who was born a slave. And so he's our touchstone with our slave history, of which we are, frankly, quite proud. Mm-hmm. And he had these 11 children, 9 of whom he sent to college. Publishing is difficult. I had no idea of all of the various facets to it. For example, we had to find someone to design the cover. Then we had to find someone to design the insides of the book. Mm-hmm. And then we had to find people who would write testimonials about the book. So if you'll see on the back, you have Willie Brown.
You have
Cornell West.
Kevin Starr, right.
Cornell West, Kevin Starr. Mm-hmm. These are a lot of people that I know. And one of them that I'm really proud of is the Pulitzer Prize winner.
David Levering Lewis.
Who is actually distantly related to my mother. His mother helped raise my mother. So
amazing.
I'm very proud of the fact that he's the Pulitzer Prize winner, author of a book about W.E.B. Du Bois. Anyway, David Levering Lewis, professor of history from New York University. At any rate, so we had to find these people to include in the blurbs on the book. And then we had to, create the publishing company, and then we had to find a distributor, and then we had to – anyway, it's very complicated, and I understand why the publishing world is in such disarray.
Yes.
It's a very difficult thing to do. And while the book is popular and we have done quite well as for a self-published book, the distribution is still very sort of – up in the air and difficult. And we plan to publish more of my mother's book. Besides this book, she published a book, or she wrote a book called No Crystal Stair, which is actually a fictionalized account of this book. It's the story of a black debutante raised in comfortable circumstances in Atlanta, Georgia, who marries a Tuskegee Airman and goes off to the world of integration. So it's my mother's story, really, in a fictionalized romance story, which my daughter finds disturbing because it goes all the way through to the second generation, her parents falling in love, her grandparents falling in love, and she's finds that a little uncomfortable.
I do find it very uncomfortable. It's just weird listening about to them kissing and dancing and looking into each other's eyes, and there's references to wedding nights.
Yes.
And I mean, there's no graphic depiction, but the door does not close soon enough for me.
But think of it from the point of view of the author who has a story to tell.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the difficulties in writing something based on one's own family, what to say and what not to say and how to present it in a sensitive manner.
I think that Grandma did No Crystal Stair. It really is the second generation. It goes into the... And I think that there was a lot of – it was her testing the waters to see how the family would take – because there's one thing about talking about your kids as kids.
Yes.
There's a whole nother thing talking about your kids as adults.
Yes.
And talking about the next generation. Mm-hmm. And I think it was a little bit of her testing the waters to see how people would take it.
Yes. It's hard to know. There's some good stories that you want to tell, but you don't want to embarrass your children. It's a dilemma when you write.
Well, and no crystal stair. I wrote a great deal about my husband.
Oh, yes. We haven't talked enough about him.
Yeah, who really did a masterful job as he worked in this world that was just becoming integrated. And he got a very good job, and he kept moving up and up. And the things that happened to him, I told in this story, in this book, and they are absolutely true.
Yes.
How he went when they were going to start a war with Russia. And he went to take some people to Germany to get ready for the fight that they were going to have. And he was a black man and leading a group of white workers. And he was very mistreated even in this trip. Across the several countries. Mm. And, well, it's a very true story in many ways.
Yes.
Yeah, when I read No Crystal Stair, I can't tell where the fiction starts and the truth ends. The fiction is so intertwined with truth in that book. So many of the accounts in it are things that actually happened to my parents. Mm-hmm. And some of them are things that happened to my friends. My mother uses... And to me and to my brothers and my brother.
Well, for a writer,
sisters.
Everything is grist for the mill.
It is.
Eva, I want to ask you a political question. Did you expect in your lifetime to see a black president and a black president's wife?
Never. I never thought there'd be a black president of the United States.
Really?
I'm so pleased and so delighted and so proud of both the president and his wife.
Yes.
I didn't think it would ever happen in my lifetime.
Oh, and there they are.
It is amazing. And I hope he gets a little cooperation and does some of the things. And he is so serious about what he's planning to do.
Yes. It has been such a joy for me to have the three of you here in the studio and to talk about the book. And Eva, it's just thrilling to meet you and to reflect on your life and your work and your accomplishments and all that you've done. And I just encourage everybody to rush right out and get this book. It's called When We Were Colored, A Mother's Story, and it's by Eva Rutland. So thank you all for taking the time to come in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. And thank you for having us.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Now we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, you'll hear the conversation that we had earlier with Eva and Ginger and Eva at the sitting room in Cotati. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Lately I find you're on my mind more than you know. More than you'll ever know.
All right, we're back with more conversation with Eva Rutland, the author of the book When We Were Colored, A Mother's Story, and Eva's daughter, Ginger, and her granddaughter, young Eva, just to distinguish between the two Evas. Our conversation took place earlier in the sitting room of Small Community Library in Cotati, which hosts authors and writing groups. You can learn more about the sitting room by going to their website. Just Google the sitting room, and it will come up. A small group of sitting room regulars were there. You'll hear the interplay between the women of three generations, Eva, Ginger, and young Eva. And on one occasion, they actually disagreed with one another, and you'll hear how they worked it all out. And now let's listen to that conversation at the sitting room in Cotati, California.
Well, the book was originally published in 1964. And it was a collection of short stories that my grandmother had published in Women's Day and Ladies' Home Journal and Red Book Magazine back in, like, the 1940s and 50s, which I think is really amazing, especially for a woman to be, you know, a black woman, too. And they were stories about being a mom. A lot of the stories didn't even have to do with being a black mom. So, like, I've seen the original, like, 50s story. And they don't have pictures, and you would just swear it was a white family, any family, because, you know, it's just raising kids. And she decided to compile it into a book in the 60s. And she took all of our articles, kind of compiled them, tarted it up, and she made a book called The Trouble with Being a Mama. And this,
no,
this came out in 1964. And it was really popular, actually, at university campuses. A lot of people who wanted to learn about, you know, the country was integrated, integrating, so for sociology classes, they always wanted the book to be like, how are we going to deal with this new integrated world? But it eventually, it went out of print around 1970, just as books usually do. And we never really thought much of it. Like, as a family, we read it. Like, I read it when I was 10 years old and couldn't put it down. But we never really thought in terms of publishing. Since then, my grandmother started writing romance novels, and she would always publish Harlequin romances. Grandma went blind in her 50s, you know, after this book was published. And that's when she started writing Harlequin romances. And then 3 years ago, my grandpa died. And my mom read a section from the chapter called The Trouble with Papa. And so many people asked for copies that we decided to publish it. And Mom was in charge of planning the initial stuff, designing it. And Mom hated The Trouble with Being a Mama as a title. Everyone else in the family disagreed. But since Mom was in charge, she made the decision to change the title. She changed it to When We Were Colored. And we redesigned. The one thing we did do is we added family pictures. The original one had no pictures. And we added an introduction. My grandmother, at the beginning, there's an introduction, about a two-page introduction where Grandma talks about the changes from the 60s to today. But otherwise, we kept the book the exact same as when it came out. Well, the only other change is a few acronyms that were referred to, like SNCC or those sorts of things. We spelled them out because people wouldn't understand what the acronyms are. But so we kept the original book, and Mom changed it, and I don't like the new title. And Mom gets angry when I say that. Mom thinks that
this is Ginger, a mother. And the reason I changed the title of the book, When We Were Colored, A Mother's Story, I never quite liked The Trouble with Being a Mama, mm-hmm. frankly, because I thought it was boring. And mm-hmm. I thought When We Were Colored was really evocative of the era. That was the polite phrase for black folks. And for me, I'd always rather liked that phrase as we went from black to African American to Afro and blah, blah, blah. I always rather liked colored, and I think I'm now fond of people of color, but at any rate, so I changed the title, and I added a little subtitle called A Mother's Story at my mother's insistence. But I think what my daughter and I have is a, what would you call it? It's a generational divide. Mm-hmm. When she sees the word colored, she thinks negative. She thinks it's going to be sad.
What I think actually is that Mom's right. I don't imply that the word is a bad word. I just think it's going to be a sad book. Because I think of Maya Angelou, you know, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, every single Toni Morrison book, anything about black people before the civil rights movement, that's what I think of. And the books that are about that tend to be, we were raped, we were lynched, and then things got bad. It's kind of how those books are. And so I think that. But the book's funny. The book is, and I think that When We Were Colored implies that the emphasis is on being colored rather than being on a mother. And the book is about being a mom, you know. And so that's Mom's thing. But Mom, and yes, it is a generational thing. Mom thinks of a different time period. We published this as a family. We had a book shepherd. We did all of this to figure out how to publish it. At first, it was published by Abington Press, but now we publish it as a family. And we had to come up with a name, so we named it IWP. Our publishing company, which stands for Isaac Westmoreland Press. And I'm not sure, that is my grandmother's grandfather.
Oh, okay.
And he was born a slave. And the thing that we like to show off as a family, and we're very proud of, is that he had 11 children. 9 survived to adulthood, and all 9 graduated from college. Cool. And so we're very proud of that.
School.
And my grandmother's mother, whose also name is Eva. Big thing about Evas in my family, gets kind of complicated. That's Eva Westmoreland, Neil. And people think that she looks like me.
Or you look like her,
that I look like her, whatever. And it's just weird to, like, me and stuff is, because all my life, like, people have been like, that's your mother? Your mother's black? Are you sure? You know, are you adopted? So this is my, no, I'm not adopted. I am my mom's kid. And personality-wise, anyone who knows us, we're definitely related.
One of the things, I want to talk about the theme of the book. This is a book about a black family. It's not, quote, the black family. It's a black family. And my mother, when she wrote this, and I guess Mom could say this herself, but in fact, Mom, would you like to say why you wrote the book?
I wrote it because we were being integrated, and I was moving from Atlanta, Georgia, where I had enjoyed my life very much. And I didn't want to move to an integrated place, which was mostly white people, because I didn't know how they were going to treat my children. And so I wrote these articles to direct them to white mothers to be kind to my children. And I was so surprised when I got prizes in the Writer magazine for both a short story that I had written in fiction, and then one about my family. And it was just sort of, be kind to my children. They're just as precious as yours.
But the other part of this is, Mom had come out of an upper middle class black existence in Atlanta, Georgia. But the images of black people that were in the wider media that were projected into the world were so different from her own experience growing up in Atlanta, Georgia, in a rather rarefied world of the black elite, right? With her parents who had both been college educated, and with uncles and aunts who had both been college educated. They were not wealthy, but they were comfortable. The father was a pharmacist, the mother was a school teacher. And yet, if you read about blacks of this era, you mainly read about people who come out of the agrarian South who pick cotton, who do that sort of thing, you don't read that there was this entire class of black folks who did quite well. And my mother came from that class. And she tells a story, and it's not the black family, but it's her black family. And it's the kind of black family that's often not discussed or talked about or read about in the wider world. So that was also part of what she did. Was the stereotypes were different from her own experience.
And I wanted to say something about this. It puzzles me. Black men were very, very smart in that time, and all became pharmacists or doctors, or really had very good jobs, businessmen and all. And the truth of the matter was that slaves had done the work. That's why black men knew what to do. And when they, during the time of my time, it was when a lot of foreigners were coming to the United States, and they needed jobs, and they wanted these black people out of the way so they could get the jobs that they could do. The black people were educated and could have done the jobs that the white men were taking over, but the white men had been waited on. I mean, the black men worked. And another one, we had about 6 or 7 colleges in Atlanta right after slavery, because the black people were ready for them. They were very smart. They had done all the work as slaves.
Atlanta was the center of black education during this time. Atlanta was always brought as this charming example of how separate but equal could work, because here was the city that was completely racially divided. I mean, just totally. And yet there were about 6 black colleges.
I'm going to move forward a little. You can tell who my dad is in this picture, I think, right? He's the black guy in the middle, right? Mm-hmm. Yes, okay, that's Dad. And this is McClellan Air Force Base. It's about 1953, or 54, actually. But I want to read only one more section of the book. And that is The Trouble with Papa. This was the part that we read that made us republish the book, because I read it at my dad's funeral, and everybody wanted the book, and it had gone out of print. At any rate, it's really one of the things that my mother was doing, beyond just sort of this image of black folks in general, was not the world in which she lived. The image of black men was really not the world that she knew about. Black men are portrayed in the wider media as being lazy and dangerous and oversexed and all of this. And that had not been my mother's experience with her father, with her husband, with anybody else that she had known and had been close with. She had lived with these heroic black men who had really gone to great lengths to try to protect her and to support her. My dad was amazing. He was amazing because my mother got sick almost from the day they got married. Right after my older sister was born, and she was born 13 months after they got married, Mom had this goiter operation, which ended up in the tracheotomy tube that you see there. So she
paralyzed her vocal cords.
I mean, there were a bunch of things that went wrong with that, but she... Then she went blind, in her 50s. But it's really about Dad, who's working for the United States Air Force. He's going all over the world selling weapons of mass destruction, frankly, to people all over the world. That was his job. He was in logistics, right? So you get an F-104 fighter jet that's going to the Saudis or the Iranians. He can tell you. I've got, when he died, I took all of this stuff out, and he had stuff from Tehran, and it was kind of interesting. Anyway, this is a story about him going around the country and the various things that happened to him. In the earlier part of it, he's yelling at the kids, and he's telling them, you can't afford to fail. A black man can't afford to fail. You can't fail. You can't fail. You can't. And Mom, who has been disputing with him about this, then starts to talk about what his life is like.
And my grandmother says, he has as much right as a white man. And my grandpa goes back and says, don't you dare plant that idea in my head. And she says,
in my children's head,
in my children's
that they can
head,
fail.
They fail. And then my grandma goes, and then I remember that it is he who is fighting and facing the outside world. And it is not always a charming and glamorous world. It's when she acknowledges that she was a stay-home mom, so she didn't have to deal with a lot of the stuff that he had to deal with. And this is him talking, and now she starts talking about his job.
Yeah. I remember the time in a borderline town when he and a white buddy entered a cafeteria and Bill was turned away. I remember that my husband was calm and dignified, and it was the buddy who raved, a man who was seeing discrimination personally for the first time in his life, and became, as Bill said, another converted white man. I remember the conference in Kentucky that Bill conducted with a leading airplane production company, and the elaborate luncheon the company had arranged for in advance. 15 men seated at the dining table all received menus except Bill. Bill, absorbed in conversation, hardly noticed. Then, as the others began to order, he asked the waitress quietly for a menu. Then came the always shocking, no matter how many times you hear it, "I'm sorry, I can't serve you." But this time from the company representative comes, "What's the matter, Bill?" His indignation, the hurried consultation with the manager who babbles about policy precedent. This time, 15 men arise and walk out. 15 men representing a powerful company that sustains that town. And as they watch them go, the waitress and the manager are a little disconcerted, as people always are, when discrimination affects their bread and butter. You get the feeling it won't happen again, and you are a little thrilled that the capable Negro man who has helped to open another door is your husband. And if you are that man's wife, you begin to understand why he roars. What he is saying to your children, it is, "I love you. I want you to be happy, to be respected." The age-old cry of the Negro father, the slave that bowed and toiled and did the white man's bidding, that his little brown babies might eat. The newly freed black man who waited tables and carried bags, that his child might be educated. A little further up the ladder, the teachers and preachers who planted a dignity, an idea to stand up, black boy, be proud, and walk straight, straight into the doors of the universities of Mississippi and Georgia, to the front of the bus, to anywhere you want to go. I know at last what my husband is roaring about. The doors are open. Be ready. And I am proud and happy and thrilled that he is helping to open them. I relax and smile and listen to him roar, and I sort out socks and polish the floor, put a log on the fire, a pie in the oven, and wait and thrill to the key in the lock, the quick masculine step, and the inevitable heartwarming first roar, "Where's your mama?"
Oh.
You can see the romance writer.
Trouble with Papa. Another trouble with being a mama is papas. Strike that. What I mean is, one of the blessings of being a mama is papas. The trouble is most papas are people, men. Papas are not quiet. They roar. At least our papa does. He roars when the house is not clean, when he can't find his socks, when dinner's not ready, when somebody's algebra teacher just phoned, when somebody's been fooling with his razor, and isn't anything sacred around here? He roars at report card time, when somebody hasn't come in yet, and if they're not splattered on some highway, he's going to kill them when they do get in. When somebody's lost his golf balls, and isn't anything sacred around here? He roars when Billy's still got that cold, and blasted no, he's not going to that football game. When Billy got spiked, and how in tarnation did that happen, and how come the idiot coach didn't know how to apply a bandage? When Billy wouldn't keep off that blasted foot like he jolly well told him to. When somebody uses bad language. When he still can't find his socks. And isn't anything sacred around here? What really gets me, and I hate to admit it, is that this roaring gets results. One quick hearty roar from Bill accomplishes more than 1,000, "Darling, will you please," from me. I don't know why, but when he's home, the grass get cut, socks get picked up, lessons get done, and dishes get washed. And another thing, nobody roars back. As a matter of fact, the children and Papa seems to have reached some sort of understanding. For instance, take the other day, when after 3 days of darlings, will you please, I finally prevail upon Bill to urge the twins to clean their room. Result, much roaring and stirring as if a tornado was tearing through that part of the house. Bill, you just better get in here and get this disgusting mess clean up, or I'm going to take it out of your ornery hides. Loud laughter from Patty Jo, who would laugh on the way to her own funeral. Daddy, you sure sound funny. You're going to look funny if you don't get this. What in blazes are you keeping this in here for? Another gay reply, whereupon Bill asserts, if you don't clean out this drawer and shut your mouth, I'm going to put my foot in it. Pat, you couldn't get your foot in my mouth. Bill, I bet if you open it wide enough, I could. Hysterics from Pat. After much roaring, cursing, etc., Pat comes through the kitchen to carry out the trash and says to me, gee, Mom, I like for Dad to help us clean out our room. He's much more fun than you. It's much more fun than me at cards, too, and ping pong, Scrabble, Monopoly, baseball, high jumping, swimming, or practically anything the family might participate in. And this I really cannot understand because he fusses, squabbles, cheats, and yells as much as the kids do. So then I comfort myself with the thought that, all right, if he's more fun than me, he's also more honest than me. And that's bad. At least it is if you are interested in children and protecting their egos. You have to lie a little. That is, you might call it lying. I call it tact. Do you think this makes me look too skinny? Elsie says. Of course not, I reply. It fits you nicely. You just have a dainty figure. Great Caesars, Bill explodes. What are you wearing that for? You look like a toothpick. Ginger, darling, I say, do you think you should have so many potatoes? You want to preserve your figure, you know. Preserve it, roars Bill. You've got too much of it now. Get those potatoes off your plate, you big fat slob. You see? No attempt to preserve their darling, vulnerable egos. I keep telling him and telling him.
You've been listening to a reading from When We Were Colored, A Mother's Story, Eva Rutland's memoir of the days that she was raising her four children. You've also heard a conversation with Eva Rutland, her daughter, Ginger Rutland, and her granddaughter, Eva Fields, that took place at the Sitting Room in Cotati. If the book is not on the shelf at your favorite independent bookstore, ask them to order it for you. All of Eva Rutland's books are available online. I want to thank everyone who made it possible for us to put this program together. I want to thank the Sitting Room for their cooperation. Especially thank Eva, Ginger, and Eva for making the trip from Sacramento and being so generous with their time and with their stories. Thanks to Suzanne Lang, who produces the show.
And thank you, Rosemary. And let's give a shout-out to Nanette Booker, who did the readings on today's show, and KRCB production engineers Mark Fuller and Sean Knight. They always make things possible.
And now that's it for this show, and we'll look forward to being with you again next month. And until then, remember, there's no such thing as too many books.